Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Emma Linda McGinnis, and I'm a grateful and enthusiastic member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. Now, you know, when Andy called me and said, "We have your name as Emelina in this program and on your, and on several other things, like that bookmark that I wanted, but it says Emelina," I said, "How important is it? I mean, all my life, people have called me Erlinda, Herlinda, Esmeralda, Emily, you know, so who cares?" So, of course, I use the slogan, "How important is it?" So I had texted Andy on Friday. We were at a marathon meeting together, and I texted her, and I said, "Hey, what time is that speaker dinner, and what's the location?" And she said, "I don't know. Let me find out about it." So I go to my room because I, you know, I know there's a speaker dinner on Friday. And so at 4 o'clock, she texts me, "The dinner's at 4:30, and it's at this location." And so now I get to thinking, you know, I have some choices. I learned in Al-Anon I have some choices. I could A, have a resentment towards all those AA convention leader committee leaders that don't tell Al-Anon people and misspell my name. Or I could do the Al-Anon salute and say, "Oh, poor me. Why is it happening to me?" Or I could use another Al-Anon tool and say, "Quit taking it personally. They're not doing it to you. They're just doing it." So I took a shower. I put my hair up. I came with no makeup. I called my husband, who was hanging out in the cigar lounge. I said, "Hey, dinner's at 4:30. And we ran there, and we were welcomed, and it was great. And that's what I've learned here in Al-Anon, that how important is it? Don't sweat the small stuff, and that's it. So here I am. Let's get this party started. I was born and raised in New York City into a large Puerto Rican extended family. I lived in New York City until I was 21. Then I moved to Hawaii. Then I went to North Carolina. And then I ended up in California in 1990. But sometimes that New York accent still comes out. So I just want to warn you about that. I live in Indio, which is in the Coachella Valley. My home group is Paths to Recovery, 10 a.m. Palm Springs meeting, where we work from the book Paths to Recovery. It is an excellent, excellent meeting. If you ever want to meet up there, I'll give you my number, and we'll go to that meeting. It's Saturday, 10 to 11:30, an hour and a half meeting. Okay, so born and raised in New York City, and we lived in a building where my grandparents lived in the apartment next to my parents. My aunt and uncle lived downstairs. Another aunt and uncle lived in another part of the building. And it was just like one big, happy, enmeshed Puerto Rican family. I didn't know that there was alcoholism in my family. I came here because my former husband's drinking bothered me. But as soon as I was here for a couple of years, I'm like, oh, my grandfather who took down the machete to try to kill my mother's boyfriend, oh yeah, that was alcoholism. And oh, my Uncle Louie who chased my brother with a knife when he was under the influence of drugs and alcohol, oh yeah, that was alcoholism. And so all of a sudden I started identifying all these things and I realized I belonged here long, long time ago rather than 1998 when I got here. So when we lived in that whole building of family, we had lots of parties. And it's called Viernes Social. That means Social Friday. And we'd have music and live music, and the beer would come out, and everyone would dance. But my idea of alcoholism was the bums on the Bowery in New York City, the transient guys who had the beer in their paper bags. That was my idea of alcoholism. Not my uncle from the Army who came and every evening drank beers and got drunk. That was not my idea of alcoholism. So at age 6, I moved from that extended family and I lived in just my nuclear family. My mom, my dad, and my 3 siblings. I'm the oldest of 4, so that makes me automatically bossy and controlling, and I loved every minute of it. It was the prerequisite to Al-Anon. And I have a sister who's 1 year younger than me. Her drinking bothers me, but she's not in recovery. I'm the only one in recovery. Then comes my brother, who's a in and out of AA, in and out of prison, in and out of drug addiction, heroin addict, and I love him, and I accept him because I'm in recovery and in Al-Anon, and hopefully one day he'll find a seat in AA. And then my younger sister, who now has since passed, she was an alcoholic and went to the Betty Ford Center. So there was 4 of us. And I was not used to being in a nuclear family. I was used to being in a big extended family where everyone has an opinion or tells you you've done this wrong or this right. And I didn't live too long in that home with my parents because my mom was a teen mom. She was 16 years old when she got married with my dad, who was a couple of years older than her. And she started having a relationship with the local butcher, who was an alcoholic. And they soon got divorced. So that was my biggest resentment. I loved my dad. And at 8 years old, when they were getting divorced and he was going to leave the home, my first resentment was towards my mom. And my mom changed. She was like cool. She was like a cool mom with like bell-bottom jeans and an afro with a bandana and lots of jewelry. And she started making brownies, but not brownies, regular brownies like I saw in Leave It to Beaver, like brownies with marijuana in it. And so I had a big resentment towards her. And things just didn't work out with living with her. So her and the butcher left that apartment, and then my dad and his young girlfriend moved into the apartment. So obviously the apartment was very valuable because they maintained the apartment and just the adults moved in and out. When that girlfriend beat up my sister and she had this big eye issue and had to be hospitalized, my maternal grandmother stepped in and said, "I'm taking the kids." And so from the 4th grade on, I lived with my grandmother. And that's where I learned how to be an Al-Anon. She was a nice Christian woman, codependent, always helped everyone, was active in church. Her house was called the Maldonado Hotel because everyone that came from Puerto Rico landed there. We had to give up our bedrooms, sleep in the pull-out couch. And I learned a lot from her. Growing up in elementary school, I was a teacher's pet. I followed guidelines. I never got in trouble. I loved all the stars, all the certificates. You know, I love me some lava. And lava is love, acceptance, acknowledgement, validation, and applause. Like, I love me some lava. And I got certificates and hung them up on the wall. And I still love me some lava. That's why I keep coming back to Al-Anon, because it's not about that. And so I was a goody-two-shoes. I was the first in my family to go to college, and I made sure I went to college 10 hours away from New York so that I can stay away from the discotheques and dancing, the hustle, and I could be far away. And I went to school in a small town up near Buffalo. It's called Fredonia, and it's up in the snow belt. That's when I realized I was a minority. I mean, in New York City, everybody's different. And I went upstate New York, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm the only brown girl here. And so in college, they didn't have a Latin student union, so I joined the black student union. And I wanted to feel a part of. I joined the track team. I joined the cross-country team. I babysat. I sewed hems for some money. And I had learned that about being self-sufficient growing up at home, because at 14, I had a youth job in the summer camp and babysat a lot. And my grandmother lived on Social Security. So as soon as I got a little job babysitting, then it was my responsibility to buy my own clothes, save money for a bike, save money for my camera. And so I had a long history of thinking that I'm responsible for myself, and I'm reliant on myself. It wasn't until I got to these rooms that I realized that there's a God, and it's not me. You know what the difference between God and me is? He never thinks he's Emma Linda. So I go away to college. I'm really busy. And I get a degree in social work, and I went to spring break to Puerto Rico. And I met up with this guy that I knew from my neighborhood when I was like 14 or 15. And I didn't like him then at 14 or 15, so I passed him on to my girlfriend. But this time around, he was smooth and suave. And when I got in the car with him, there was music. He'd snap his fingers, and he smelled good, cologne, Paco Rabanne. And he was just my height, but his charisma was, he was like 6 feet tall. You know what I mean, ladies? You know those kind of guys, those bad boy guys that you should stay away from? Well, I know that how I got into that problem was I had a couple of drinks before I got courageous enough to go say, hey, why are you going to take that girl home when you could take me home? And I realized it was those mint puffs that I had taken that gave me that courage. And so I decided that I was going to help him, because after all, my major was social work. And I have this internal fixometer, and the fixometer was dialed up to this guy needs help. So who cared that he was the local drug dealer of the neighborhood? So we planned the perfect wedding. I needed to let you know that when my parents got divorced, like backing up a little bit, my parents got divorced and I went to go live with my grandmother, I felt angst and anxiety, and I didn't quite know what I needed to do about that. And what I did was starting to just organize everything. I organized my closets, I organized my drawers, I color-coded myself. You know, my headband had to match my bracelet, that had to match my ring, that had to match my lanyard, kind of like today, you see? I have this lanyard, this blue with the blue matchy-matchy. And I used to do that as a kid because it felt me like a sense of control and calmness and safety. Today I do it because, you know, I like it. But back then, I got into that organizational thing. So when I was planning my wedding, I planned the perfect wedding because I'm a perfectionist and obsessive. And so red roses and red flowing dresses for the bridesmaids. Everything was great and wonderful. It was beautiful. I had an open bar, and we had chicken cordon bleu, and we had a live band. I mean, drug dealers have a lot of money. So we had a big wedding. There was just one problem. When I was ready to go down the aisle, the police swarmed in and got my groom and arrested him. Not for being a drug dealer, but for attempted murder. You see, and you thought Al-Anon talks were boring and only AAs have a good talk, right? So they whisked my groom to be gone. I rushed up the stairs. I see all these police cars. I come down. I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I talked to my aunt, and I talked to my sister. My sister was married to a military guy then. And she said, you know, we could get you married by proxy. In New York City, you could get married by proxy. And I said, well, what the heck? The band's here. The food's here. The people are here. Who the hell needs a groom? So I put my little hat on, and I went down that aisle with my dad. My mom already started getting drunk because she was like, holy crap, I told her not to marry that guy. And I went down the aisle, and I married my brother-in-law. Now, I didn't have program at that time. I didn't know I had choices. That was the disease of perception. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have 12 steps. I didn't have a lifeline. I just did that without a higher power. Now, the minister who married us, me and my brother-in-law, at the reception, he said, listen, if you don't mail these papers in, you won't really be married. And I said, are you kidding me? I gotta stand by my man. I mean, I'm an Al-Anon. When I did the fourth step, I realized I accept unacceptable behavior. I'm loyal to a fault. And I have a fixometer. So, of course, I'm not going to not mail in these papers. I mean, I need to be his wife so I could visit him in prison. And not testify against him about those money machines and all the stuff that we have in the house. So I mail the papers in. He bails out. Oh, by the way, the next day from the wedding, he was on the front page of the New York Post with a tuxedo and his handcuffs behind him. I'm still trying to get that article from them. And just so you can know, it's true. And so he bails out. We get one of these John Gotti lawyer guys. And we go to the hearing. And he says, if I were you, I'd jump bail. Because they're not looking so good. So that's how we got to Hawaii. So I left New York City. We're on the lam for like 2 years. None of my bridesmaids know where I'm at. We're undercover, right? We're there for like 2 years. And then we moved to Puerto Rico because he has this bright idea of starting a nightclub. And we did. We opened up a nightclub in Old San Juan. And we're there. I get pregnant with twin boys. And the babies were 4 months old. and he's setting up their swing. And all of a sudden, all of these FBI guys are surrounding our house with these big guns, these rifles. And he goes off to a jail in Puerto Rico. Now, how did that happen? Well, we found out later that my drug addict brother read this flyer that said, if your tip can lead us to an arrest, you could get $500. So as a good heroin addict, he got $500 and my husband got 20 to life. And so he went from Puerto Rico, he got extradited to New York. Now, I wasn't in Al-Anon then. I didn't know I had choices. He's going to get 20 to life. I could say, you know what, this is not going to work for me. I'll be a single mom. I have a lot of support in Puerto Rico. No, I was an untreated Al-Anon. I accept unacceptable behavior. I'm loyal to a fault. So for 4 years, I ran the nightclub. I had twin sons that I was breastfeeding. I got involved in La Leche League. I started a Mothers of Twins organization in Puerto Rico. I started a nonprofit organization for that. I had an office. And you know what I got? I got so busy so I won't feel any pain. And my twins and I went every 4 weeks to New York, rented a car, drive up to the penitentiaries, visit my husband, had conjugal visits, like if nothing happened, for 4 years. And I did not have the courage to end that marriage. So I had an overlapping relationship. An overlapping relationship sounds so much better than an extramarital affair. He was a family friend. I met him in my own house on Christmas Eve. I wasn't out looking for him. He was my sister's husband's best friend. He was married too. But man, I looked at him, he looked at me, he was 6 feet tall, trim, he had a Marine Corps uniform on, and he drank Heinekens. Now, I didn't know he was an alcoholic. And he had nice cologne. And he snapped his fingers to the beat of salsa. And he was a salsa dancer. So he's taller than the other one, and he upped his game with dancing. So, of course, I was attracted to him. And so I quickly got divorced within that year. And he quickly got divorced in April. I think I got divorced April 4th, and he got divorced April 7th, and we got married April 29th. And that's how I got to North Carolina. I became a military wife, and I joined the association of the Navy Federal whatever association, my twin boys were on the plane. And I'm very open and talk about everything to them. And I said, we're going to go to North Carolina on the plane. And Daddy, he's going to drive the minivan to North Carolina. And so on the plane, the kids are talking to people and saying, I have two dads. I have one dad that's in jail for a long, long time because he did bad things. And then I have another dad, but he's driving to North Carolina. And I'm like, from North Carolina to California. And then I had to tell them, you know, we don't share everything about our family. You know, try to get that discussion, like the family meeting people talked about in the morning. So I get to North Carolina, and I realize that he works a lot, and he drinks a lot of Heinekens on the weekends. And I'm thinking, you know, that he's not rowdy, and he doesn't get so angry, but he drank a lot. And then we get a transfer to California. Now, in North Carolina, there's not much to do. But in California, you get to 29 Palms, there's nothing to do. But you can drive to Palm Springs, and you could drive to San Diego. So let the games begin. Because that's when I realized that he had an issue. And so I thought, well, maybe it's because it's a blended family. You know, he has two sons from his first marriage, and I have two sons, and we have this daughter together. Maybe it's just a blended family issue. And why is it tense around our dinner table? Like, why do we have to walk on eggshells? And maybe it's, you know, it's a big responsibility. And why can't he do things this way? And why does he lie about mailing the mortgage check? I mean, why can't he just say, oh yeah, it's in the glove compartment, I haven't done it yet? Like, why for little minor things he lies when it could be just so simple? And why when he says he's gonna come straight home, he doesn't come home straight home, and he gets home at 2 o'clock in the morning and he smells like a woman's perfume? And, you know, all of these things, like, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I've married someone that's not reliable and honest and trustworthy. But I couldn't quite figure it out. What was it? And so I dragged him to counseling, and I read a whole bunch of books, and I couldn't quite get the marriage that I had in my head, because I have a picture in my head of how things should look like and what things should be like. And I had this idea that we should all be at the dinner table holding hands and swaying and singing Kumbaya, you know, and it wasn't like that. It's like, is he going to get mad? Is he going to say something? And I had an idea that we were going to be intimate and vulnerable and have these conversations. And that didn't occur. He was raised in an alcoholic home. His father beat him to death. His mother was a doormat. So I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't realize that he was an adult child of an alcoholic. I didn't realize that I was an adult child of an alcoholic. But I wanted what I saw on TV. I wanted Darren and Elizabeth Montgomery kind of picture. I wanted him coming home with a briefcase, and I wanted things looking like that. And so because I couldn't control him, I controlled my home. So I color-coded the kids. One of my sons was blue, the other one was green, and my daughter was pink. And we had pink hangers, pink towels, pink blankets, pink cups that you put in the freezer, pink, blue, and green. And blankets, pink, blue, and green. So if anybody left anything out, I knew who they belonged to. And their buckets of toys, the Ninja Turtles have to go in the red buckets. The Legos have to go in the blue buckets. Don't let there be a Ninja Turtle in the Lego bucket. That was not okay with me. And I remember a time where my son Jacob was building some Lego thing, and I said, okay, it's lunchtime, come on, clean everything up. No, I'm still working on it. Nope, you got to put everything away and come for lunch. And he yelled and screamed, I can't be this perfect kid that you want me to be. I'm going to kill myself. He was in second grade. I took him to counseling, And the counselor said, there's nothing wrong with him. You, I'll make an appointment with you. That's how I got into counseling. And they could not play in the living room. They could play in their rooms with the Barbie dolls and all that stuff. I had a living room. That was the museum. We only sat there to talk. And we had one of those talks when I put this, I went to Radio Shack and I bought this device and I plugged it to the phone jack so that I can hear everything that my husband was saying while I was at work. And I'd come home from work at lunch, put in the new tape, take out the old tape to see, because I knew I was going to bust him in something. I didn't quite know what it was. I never busted him. But I busted my son in middle school smoking pot. He talked to the drug dealer and say, will you accept $10 in quarters for the pot? And so we had one of those conversations in the museum living room after I busted him with the pot stuff. So I was really crazy with the kids. They had bicycles, and I got orange masking tape, and I did parking spots for them in my garage so that the bikes would line up there. I mean, I didn't realize I was crazy. I thought I was perfect. So one time my sisters said, hey, I see your husband downtown Palm Springs. Didn't you say that he had a convention in San Diego? I call the babysitter. I march myself to Palm Springs. I see his car. I take his car and I move it to my sister's house. Just so that he thinks that someone stole the car. I look through all the bars, all the places. I see him. He comes out. I slap him on the face and his glasses go off and someone said, did you see what that woman do to that Marine? I mean, it talks about that in our literature, about understanding ourselves. We get so angry, out of control. How could this nice goody-two-shoes from New York City get to be a raging, crazy woman? He'd come home late at night. I have four-poster bed. I take that poster bed out, and I whack him in the arm, all bruises. This is a six-foot guy now. He's not a Marine. He's a cop in Palm Springs, and I'm beating him up. I mean, I realize now that's domestic violence. I realize now that's something I'm not proud of, and I made amends to him for that. So I have this internship at mental health, and I'm reading this sheet. If you answer yes to these 20 questions, you may be an alcoholic. I go home. I know what's wrong with you. I know what's wrong with you. You're an alcoholic. And I didn't realize it because he's a periodic drinker. When he drank, he didn't stop drinking. When he drank, he gave up the mortgage money and the paycheck. When he drank, he stayed late. So, you know, I figured that out. And it was through therapy in 1987 that the therapist referred me to Al-Anon. And that's how I got to Al-Anon. Now, I go to Al-Anon and at least 5 years of the hee-hees. He did this and he did that and hee-hee-hee-hee-hee-hee. I mean, I was perfect. There was nothing wrong with me. It was all him. How can I get him to do what I think my mind says it ought to look like? And Al-Anon did not save my marriage. But I came there to fix him, and what I got was a relationship with God, and I got to discover me. I never even knew who I was because so busy fixing everybody else. And, you know, he did everything he could. He went to the Betty Ford Center outpatient program. He went to some AA meetings. We went to some couple stuff. But I learned in the big book that there's those that are unable to be rigorously honest. And when I realized that he was one of those, oh my gosh, I had to dissolve the marriage. And it hurt me so much because my kids didn't really realize. They never saw the alcoholism in our house. They didn't see him drunk. They didn't see the things that he did in the back end of that. And it was very, very painful for me. And the most thing that was most painful for me was that I ended up losing my daughter in that nasty child custody dispute. Now, isn't it ironic that I, at that time, was a child custody mediator? In family law, know all the ins and outs, but alcoholism won. He was sneaky and slimy and turned her against me, and she wouldn't come to visit me. She went to go live with him. She uninvited me to her high school graduation. But my sister was a city assemblywoman then, state assemblywoman, and I got me some front row tickets to her graduation. Because I'm resourceful, and I was there in that front row. But it was very sad for me, because after the graduation ended, I was the only parent walking back to the parking lot, and everyone else was taking pictures with their children. And thankfully, years later, he made amends to me at my daughter's college family weekend, and he said, "I'm so sorry I turned her against you and cheated you out of those years with her. I was so angry at you for divorcing me. I thought you never would do that." And so he made amends. And the women from Al-Anon, they just were there supporting me, sharing with me their stories of their relationships with their daughters. And my daughter finally reached out to me in her, I think her first year of college, and she emailed me, "Can you give me the recipe for, you know, this and that?" I said, "She thinks she's just gonna slide in there after not talking to me and ask me for a recipe? No, you and I would need to talk." And to make a long story short, I went to Long Beach, I met her there. We have a wonderful relationship. She calls me her person. I just hosted her baby shower, and she set limits and boundaries with me, which she learned in Alateen. And I respected those limits and boundaries. And she calls me every day, and I could have not had a relationship with her like that had it not been for Al-Anon. Now, my sons, I paid them $10 each to go to an Alateen meeting. I realize that that's called control and manipulation. And so they know a couple of things because of that. And anytime I got mad, the three kids and I would just scream out the serenity prayer. So I am not sorry that I paid for those $10 for each meeting. They were very well worth it. In Al-Anon, I realized that pain is inevitable and suffering is optional. My sister died abruptly, and my son, one of the twins, he called me that weekend and said, "Mom, I'm hearing voices at the study hall and there's nobody there, and I hear whistling." And I thought, oh my God, this is schizophrenia. And he says, "I'm going to come down to the desert." He was in San Diego, and "I'm going to spend time with my favorite aunt, my sister." And he comes and stays with her, and she shares with him, "I'll support you. I'll be there for you. I have bipolar disorder. I'll go through you with the medication. You'll be all right." He spends the night there, and the next day he finds her dead in the bathroom. He finds her. He's already having a break, a psychotic break. I was in Sacramento during that time. He called me, he called my other sister, he handled everything perfectly. And we had a funeral for her. And my Al-Anon friends just brought a meeting to my home, decorated my backyard, put up tables. Everyone from the memorial went there. And my family was like, "Who are all these white people?" That's my Al-Anon family. And, you know, being raised in New York City, everybody's a different color. Then when I went upstate, then I'm a minority. And then I had this whole issue. I'm like, am I good enough, smart enough, white enough? Then I come to Al-Anon, and I'm like, oh, my God, they speak the language of the heart. They don't even care what color I am. They don't care. They love me like I am, even if I wear lime green shoes. You know, I mean, oh, my God, these people love me. They get me. And, because Al-Anon doesn't have color. It's just we speak the language of the heart. So my son at my sister's memorial said, I came here to spend time with my favorite aunts, and I'm going to get treatment. And thankfully, through another Al-Anon friend, we got a 90-day free bed at the Betty Ford. It was an AA and Al-Anon couple. And he got his help there through the marijuana using. And this is just incredible. He ended up being where my sister's bed was. He was there. My sister had previously attended Betty Ford, and that was a God thing, that there he was where his favorite aunt had been there years ago. That son now just graduated with an MBA. He doesn't take any psychotropic medication. He's happily married. My Al-Anon helps me with that. Al-Anon. I had to do acceptance. And when I got into Al-Anon, I became the literature person because I could take all those free books home and read them for free and then come back with that blue bucket the next Sunday because I'm an opportunist. And I didn't have to buy all those books. I joined Heart to Heart and was on one of those skits. I went to conventions. I did the 12 steps. I didn't have a sponsor, but that first meeting that I went to, I got all the books, and I thought, I'm smart. I could just read all these books, and then that's it. And I didn't come back for a year. I got crazy enough with color coding and the Radio Shack stuff. And I came back for a year, and this July, I'll have 25 years in the program. And I did what they told me to do. Read the books, go to meetings, get a sponsor. At that second meeting that I went and I decided I was going to stay, I asked the woman there, do you have a sponsor? Yeah. Can you give me her number? I didn't know that you had to, like, come to a couple of meetings and see if you want what they have. And I knew I needed something. So I got that woman's number, and she lived up in Yucca Valley. That's where I worked, 30 minutes away from Palm Springs. And she was the best sponsor for me. She was cut. She was chunky, and she smelled good. And she baked brownies with no marijuana. And she was like my mom. I needed that as a first sponsor. And after a year, she said, you'll need to get someone that's closer to you. And that's where I got my Betty Boo. And I got her until she died a couple of years ago. And it was in Al-Anon that I accepted my mom. I had that resentment for a long time. She would give me cards. I'm so proud of you. I'm like, why are you proud of me? My grandmother raised me. I didn't tell her those things because I'm a people pleaser and I don't want to hurt you. But I didn't release my resentment until I heard someone share in Al-Anon. And I realized, you know, she was 16. She was 20 years old with four kids. She grew up with an alcoholic dad with a machete. I mean, what did I expect? And I had unrealistic expectations. And that's why I had that resentment. And then she had cardiomyopathy and diabetes, and she was always going to the hospital, and I always had like, ugh, I have to work, I gotta go to the hospital, I gotta be nice, I have to do, you know, I gotta be a good daughter and go visit, always with resentment. And so an Al-Anon friend said, you know, when you go to her house, do to her what you wish she would do to you. And I went to her house, and I put my arm around her shoulder. And I kind of squeezed her a little bit. That was step one. And then another time she was in the hospital, I got in the hospital bed with her and squeezed her a little bit. And I started asking her story, how she grew up, how her boyfriends and marriages all were alcoholic and being beat up. And then I started having compassion for her and empathy and saying like, wow, I'm so lucky. My life is so great. And one of the times she was in the hospital and my sister was to the right of her and I was to the left, and she said, Emelinda, I want to say I'm sorry for being a bad mom. And my sister said, oh, mom. Yeah. I'm like, shut up, Bonnie. I've been waiting for this all of my life. And she made amends to me. And about a year later, she died. And she was a really great grandmother to my children. She made amends that way. And now as a grandma, I'm singing the songs that she used to sing, and I'm doing the things, and I'm like, oh, my mom used to do this. My mom used to. And so I could think of her with love and no resentment. And Al-Anon gave me that. I wouldn't have had that had it not been for Al-Anon. So, you know, my first guy, I picked bad. And the second alcoholic, I picked bad. My picker is bad. So I decided I'm not going to pick anymore. I'm going to go to eHarmony and let them pick for me. And they picked Gordon. Now, I had already been in Al-Anon for a couple of years, right? But that fixometer and that obsession with fixing others is big. Like, the alcoholic is obsessed with the alcohol, and I'm obsessive with the fixing and thinking. And he's just not the guy that I would have picked for me. I mean, he's short. He's not 6 feet tall like the last alcoholic. He didn't wear cologne. He wears cologne now. He didn't wear cologne. And our first date was at Las Cazuelas in Palm Springs. And he says, oh, let's dance. He can't snap the finger to the beat. And he can't hold the beat. So I'm like, and then he wears these Tommy Bahama shirts, which I've grown to love. And some like round toe shoes. I'm like, no, it has to be square toes. So I was judging him right from the beginning. And we talked for a long time. I came with my paperwork of eHarmony with highlighted things. I said, we have this thing in common. We have that in common. I looked you up on the internet. I understand that you're a city councilman. And you're on these committees. I'd like to know if you have any children. And he has two ex-wives and they get along. Oh, that's a check. That's a plus. What kind of parenting plan did you follow? Have you ever been in and out of court? No. Oh, another check, you know. And I continue assessing that for 2 years before I said I was going to marry him. Now, my fixometer was activated, and I said, he wore, you know, I went back to you could wear glasses. See, but he had these big, gigantic, like, square glasses, and I said, you're going to have to wear contact lenses. I don't like the look of those glasses. And he said, okay. He got contact lenses. And then I'm like, you know, you have a space in your teeth. And I don't like to see that space. And he got braces. He said, you know, I have insurance. Him and his son got braces. And he has two sons. And, you know, we're going to have to get rid of some of these clothes. I don't like all these. Oh, he used to wear, like, car shirts, like Route 66 and Corvettes on it, and I'm like, that's not my vibe. I'll have to help you go through your closets. And he has one of these like sporting jackets with all those letters. He's never going to fit into that, but I let him keep it. And, you know, I just could not accept that he was so nice and calm. And we went one weekend away to Pismo. And on the way back, I'm like, oh, my God, this guy is so boring. He doesn't curse. When he says he's going to come at 6, he shows up at 6. He's reliable. He's accountable. He's kind-hearted. There's no drama. I don't, like, you know, like, there's a lot of serenity. How can I get used to this? And all my Al-Anon friends were like, you know, just, he's a nice guy. Give him a chance. And he'd come over to visit my grandmother and my mom, and they're like, how's Melinda treating you? You okay? And then she goes, well, you know, she gives me lots of recommendations. And my younger sister cracking up, recommendations, recommendations. She's a drill sergeant. She's controlling. But he didn't see it that way. He just thought, sure, I'll do that. And then things were getting hot because he took me to Sedona. I had always wanted to go to Sedona. He took me to Sedona and he gives me this band, and he wants to get engaged. And he goes, I just got a regular, you know, platinum band. You could change it if you want. Damn right I'm going to change that. That's not in my picture, you know. And then I thought, oh, my gosh, he's getting serious. So then I upped the ante. You know, we need to go to engagement encounter. And we went, and we were the youngest couple in the group. The oldest couple there, you know, it's engagement encounter, like marriage encounter. And I had him read Dr. Phil's relationship book. And there's 10 in his family. He has 9 siblings. And I started interviewing all his family members. And I interviewed the first wife, who he was only married to for 7 months. And she said, you know, she was 14 years older than him. She said, he's a great guy. He, you know, our age difference was the issue. And I'm like, okay. And then when the second wife came out of drug rehab and he offered her the couch on his bed because that's the mother of my son, he says. And I talked to her and she says, he's the greatest guy ever. I don't know how he could put up with my bipolarness for 10 years. He never yelled. He'll remember your birthday, your anniversary. And after all of my fear, after hearing her, I said, okay, I'll marry you. We set a date. And this May, we'll be married 17 years. So after that engagement, I thought, oh, my gosh, you're going to have to go get a physical and a colonoscopy because I'm not going to be taking care of no old guys. Now, you know, you get a colonoscopy when you're 50, and he was only like 45. So he goes to the doctor and he goes, I need a physical and a colonoscopy. And he says, well, we don't do colonoscopy. Well, my fiance wants a colonoscopy. And so he did the colonoscopy. And then while we were dating, I said, because we were both in our 40s, I said, I don't want to have any more children. I don't want to put any hormonal stuff. You'll need to get a vasectomy. And he did. So I know in the AA book that it says there that you could go through great lengths. Well, Gordon went through great lengths to get me. And he did all of this stuff. And I'm making amends to him every day after I realize what I did. Because he's the perfect guy for me. At our wedding, I said, I'm getting married for the first time to the right person. So that's how I came. and how I got into Al-Anon and what my life is like today. I have a God, and it's not me. I wake up in the morning, and I do a third step prayer before my feet hit the ground. I do an 11th step, and I said, God, here I am, out of tension. Tell me what you need from me. Guide me. And then I step on the floor, and I forget all about that. And I'm not a slow learner, but I'm a quick forgetter. And I forget and forget and forget. That's why I have to go to lots of meetings, because I forget that there's a God and there's a plan, and it's not my plan. I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. I work on my steps. I meet with her every week for an hour on Zoom. We just did 2 years of Blueprint for Progress. And we're currently working with Drop the Rock, which is an AA book, because I want it to be more extensive, just like the Blueprint for Progress. So I'm always working on my steps. I do my daily readers. I go to South Africa every morning at 7 a.m. for the daily readers. They read Hope for Today, Courage to Change, and One Day at a Time at 7 a.m., three readers. If you want the Zoom numbers, I have it for you. Then at 8 o'clock, it's the 30-minute daily readers in L.A. They read the same three readers, 30 minutes. So I don't really do coffee. I do that. And that plugs me in until I forget, right? So there's meetings all over the world through Zoom, and I plug myself into that. I journal. And sometimes Gordon goes, what are you doing, writing a book? I thought it was just about today. But I do my 10th step there. I empty my head. And that helps me empty my head. I do meditation. And I do that through the Calm app, because I get it free through Kaiser. And I'm an opportunist. I'm not going to pay no whatever, whatever. It's free. I do slogans. One of my favorite slogans is live and let live, but don't live with me. Because if you live with me, I'm going to be so neurotic, so obsessive, taking your inventory, telling you what you ought to do, even though you didn't ask me, and then you're going to be grateful for it, I'm sure. So don't live with me, because that triggers that thing. I also like, wait, why am I talking? Sometimes I'm talking because it was like, hey, look at me. I'm color-coded. Aren't I cute? Say something. Or, wait, why am I still talking? So I'm practicing listen and learn. And so I go to these Zoom meetings, and I just want to do a lot of learning. So I keep quiet. I ask myself, what's in my best interest? I always think first, what's in your best interest? Let me do an individual service plan and tell you what you ought to do. And I'll follow up with you. And because I'm so obsessive, I'll put it on my calendar and tell you with an alert when I'm going to follow up with you, even though you did not ask me. I use my God box. I put everything in there. Those twin sons, they didn't talk to each other. They had a falling out. And when my son got married, my other son, who was going to be the best man, said, I'm not coming to your wedding. And I thought, what? What about the pictures? I'm thinking about, you know, the pictures, the look. No matter what we did, he set his boundary and he didn't come. And then the next son, he got married 2 or 3 years later, and he didn't invite his brother to the wedding. And by that time, I knew, who cares about pictures? How important is it? And what I had to do was acceptance. I didn't like it. I didn't have to approve of it, but I had to accept it. I finally had to have peace. I couldn't manipulate. Ooh, for Thanksgiving, I could sit them here and they'd just say, Mom, stay out of it. We'll be light and polite. I heard that phrase in Al-Anon, one of the speakers, and I had shared it, and now there he was throwing it back in my face. We'll be light and polite. And it was light and polite for at least 4 years. Now they're talking again. But they're in my God box. I had to leave it there. Boundaries. I set boundaries. I'm going to go on a big family cruise. And I set the boundary. I'm not going to be the babysitter. You guys are not paying my way. However, I'm willing to take care of the baby during the evening when we, Gordon and I, will go to the early shows. You'll go to the evening shows. And then after that, we'll hand you back the baby. And I would have been able to do a bounty like that had it not been for Al-Anon. Say what you mean what you say, don't say it mean. I don't drag people to Al-Anon anymore. I don't hand out Courage to Change to my coworkers. I check my motives before I do something. I used to work at a courthouse, and I used to always do my reports late. And I would always go to the location where you have your court report with a cake from Coco's. Now, what was my motive? So that they don't look how late my report was coming. Now, if I buy a cake, it's because I want to, because I think it's a nice thing, not because I'm trying to be shady. My sponsor's working a lot with me on this, so that if no one asks for my help, I have to zip my lips. So I want to have a sign like this, like, ask me, ask me, ask me, ask me anything. I'm the resource person. But no, if they don't ask me, I have to zip my lip. It was really hard to mind my business, so I have to use tools like hocus pocus, where's my focus? Or not my pig, not my farm, E-I-E-I-O. Or stay in my square, or stay in my lane. At work, I used to use noise-canceling headsets because I'm like, I know where that is. It's room 103. And the secretary will look back at me and said, and Melinda, shut up. No, I'm the secretary. You're the mediator. I had to start wearing head-canceling phones because I couldn't help myself. In my head, I have an itty-bitty shitty committee. And that committee, I need to not listen to it. It gets me in a bad neighborhood, and I want to start manipulating and have my magic wand and kind of line things up. And that's not good for me. I'm less fearful. I do first things first. I started writing in a book. I called it my courage book. And I started jotting down everything that I did that was courageous. I asked my son, please come and pick up the children no later than 3 p.m. I need to get ready for work for the next day. 7 p.m. doesn't work for me anymore. So I put it in my courage book. I had the courage to tell my coworker, I'm sorry, I can't take that case for you. I have to write reports. I said no to a coworker. I put it in my book. And all of a sudden, it became easier and easier to say no, set a boundary, put a limit, because I was practicing. And now I have a toot-toot book. I toot my own horn. I don't wait for anyone to say, atta girl. I don't wait for any lava or validation or acceptance or acknowledgement. So anytime I do self-care, I write it in my toot-toot book. Good for you. You took a nap instead of overextending yourself and volunteering for that. Toot-toot! I paused before returning a call to an Al-Anon fellow and instead did my priority, which is to pray, read, and do my meditation. Toot-toot! I told an Al-Anon fellow I had to get off the phone because I had a TV date with Gordon. Toot, toot. Because before I thought, oh, it's Al-Anon. I got to stay there. So every time I am thoughtful or I zipped my lip or I didn't give someone unsolicited advice, which is criticism, when I wasn't being a scorekeeper, when I did first things first or priorities, I put it in my toot-toot book. And this book is filling up, too. And so my life today is greater than I ever could have dreamed of. Ever, ever in my wildest dream. I've been retired for a year. I live in Indio now in a 55 and older community, and that's like summer camp for seniors. I mean, we're having so much fun. There's pickleball, there's swimming, there's yoga. I'm so busy with that and my commitments to Al-Anon. I'm going to be the outreach coordinator because I'm going to let Coachella Valley know that Al-Anon exists. And I love when people ask me to speak because I get to look at what it was like, how I got to Al-Anon, and how my life is today. And boy, I'm just so blessed and so happy. And thank you for letting me share.